Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Hawaii is poised to become the first state to ban certain sunscreens, not because they're bad for people necessarily, but because they've been implicated in the decline of coral reefs. The ban specifically targets sunscreens that contain two chemicals, oxybenzone and octinoxate, and it's just waiting for the governor's signature. Now, corals are facing a lot of challenges. Water temperatures are rising, ocean acidity is increasing, and there's a variety of pollution and even physical damage from fishing and tourism. So how much could this ban do to help? Craig Downs is executive director of the nonprofit research and advocacy group Hereticus Environmental Laboratory. Craig, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
What do we know about these two chemicals, oxybenzone and octinoxate? How do they affect corals? What kinds of problems do they cause?
So we know a lot about them. They affect not just corals, but also fish, sea urchins, and shrimp, crabs, lobster. We know that they're quite toxic at very low levels, and low levels means in the parts per trillion. And they're toxic in a number of different ways. For corals, they can induce coral bleaching at a lower temperature. Corals normally bleach around 30 degrees Celsius, about 81, 82 degrees Fahrenheit. But we can get them to bleach at 76, 77 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's a much cooler temperature. They're genotoxic, which means it damages their DNA, and it deforms the juvenile or embryonic stages of corals, just like it deforms fish embryos. So it's quite pernicious, quite toxic.
As you've mentioned, the hormone-like effects of oxybenzone aren't limited to corals, other ocean animals for that matter. There's some evidence of human impacts, but a lot of what we know is based on laboratory experiments using rather high concentrations of these and similar chemicals. So how relevant, really, are those laboratory studies to thinking about the situation of corals out on a coral reef somewhere?
Well, it's the only legal way to do this type of testing, and we do it even for humans. So, when we have a new pesticide and we want to know its toxic effects, we don't go out and spray humans. That's usually after the EPA, certifies and registers the chemical, and then we see adverse side effects after it's been registered. So we do the laboratory studies, and actually the levels weren't all that high. The levels were, we tested as low as 10 parts per trillion in the laboratory, and we saw an effect. So they are toxic, and we go out and measure the levels of oxybenzone in the environment, and we find that the levels we see in the environment are toxic in the laboratory.
When you see those levels in the environment, how sure are we that that just comes from sunscreen washing off of swimmers' bodies? I mean, these chemicals are present in other products, and couldn't they be coming from perhaps sewage or runoff from other sources besides sunscreens?
That's a really good question. In many cases, it's a double whammy. It's coming from sewage and from swimmers. And that should make you pause, because if it's coming from sewage and it's out there on the reef and in the water, that means you're swimming in sewage water. But there are some bays where we know there aren't any sewage inputs, like in Hawaii, Hanama Bay pumps their sewage outside of the bay and it goes to a municipal wastewater treatment system. So the only impact is what people bring on their bodies onto the reef. There's another nature reserve in Maui called Ahihi. It's on a lava flow, and it kind of stinks to walk there on a lava flow. And there's nobody around. I think the closest house is Steven Tyler's house from Aerosmith, literally. We sampled water right in front of his house, and he was sitting there in his board shorts. The levels are fairly high coming from swimmers in areas where swimmers are at, and they're at a low steady state in areas where sewage is persistently impacting them. And that's a lot of places, not just in Hawaii, but all through the Caribbean.
How long can these chemicals last in the environment, and how far can they spread?
These chemicals can last in the environment from 90 days to 2.5 years. And the science is leaning towards the 2.5 years. So that's a half-life, 90 days to 2.5 years. So they're fairly persistent, and they can spread pretty far. For example, we did one study where we saw a source of swimmers of sunscreen. There was nothing else along the coast, and we detected it over 6 miles away. An Okinawa science team detected it over 1.5 miles away from a swimming beach. So they can go pretty far. We detect oxybenzone all the way up into Barrow, Alaska. So it's all over the place.
Of all of the threats facing corals, changing ocean chemistry, rising water temperatures, other possible pollution, fishing, tourism, all of this, how important really is this sunscreen piece of the puzzle? Or is it, as you mentioned earlier, the additive effects of all of these that we really need to be worrying about?
We need to be worrying about the additive effects foremost. So, climate change, sewage, agriculture all have an impact. They kill the coral reefs. But the idea here is that this sunscreen, because it's always there, it's being refreshed and renewed every day, it doesn't allow the next generation of corals to come in. And this means that in a couple of years, in like 10 years, the whole reef disappears. And that's what we're seeing in many places in the Florida Keys, in the Caribbean, and now in Hawaii, is this desolation. The reefs have disappeared. Nothing's come back. This law mitigates or prevents one of the biggest sources of pollution that prevents new baby coral and baby fish from coming back onto a reef area. And it's really important for humans because the reefs that tourism impacts the most with sunscreen are the reefs that we all see. Those are the reefs that are most valued by the tourism industry, by visitors. So they're worth billions of dollars. And if they're not there, then what do you have? You don't have anything, especially as a natural resource tourism attraction. So this is the reason why I believe the Hawaii government went ahead in this wanting to ban and regulate this, is to allow for sustainable tourism to occur. Right now, tourism is unchecked in most places in the Caribbean and most places in the Pacific. This is, I think, a very forward and visionary way of maintaining the numbers of tourists coming to an area, but at the same time mitigating or lessening their impact on what tourists are visiting.
Assuming that the governor does sign this legislation and the ban goes into effect, how long do you think it will be before we might know if it's working, if it is, in fact, helping the reefs? Could we know, within a year or 2 years, or is this something that it may take 10 years to know if this has had a significant effect?
Well, we can know within 3 to 6 months if oxybenzone levels have dropped, and we would know probably in a year if it's not a climate change year or a year affected by, like, El Nino. We would know within a year because we can measure the number of baby corals that come to a reef and recruit onto the reef. The same thing with sea urchins and the same thing with fish.
This is an issue where, a ban perhaps could force changes in what products are made available by sunscreen producers, but there's also in the other 49 states of the United States and the rest of the world a consumer burden here. Can you make any recommendations for what types of sunscreens people might want to be looking for if they want to avoid these chemicals?
Sure. There's no consumer burden because every single sunscreen manufacturer creates and has right now on their shelves sunscreen product that is an SPF 30 or higher, FDA compliant, that doesn't contain oxybenzone or actinisate. They're in Costco, they're in Walmart, they're in CVS, drugstores. They're on the shelves. And oftentimes, they're put on a shelf with a label saying oxybenzone free. A lot of industry, the distributors, the resorts, the airlines, have really gotten on board to help educate the public to reduce their impact on this natural resource because all these industries depend on that natural resource. If it goes, you're not going to have a lot of people going to Hawaii to go visit and enjoy the reefs. You're not going to have people going to the beaches.
Craig Downs is executive director of the nonprofit research and advocacy group Hereticus Environmental Laboratory. Craig, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And that's our show. Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Coming up next week, researchers used to think that the window for easily learning a language closed at about 4 or 5 years old. Turns out it's more like 17 years old. How did that happen?
Since all the hypotheses are really about a completely different age, they're all sort of wrong.
That's next time on Living Lab Radio. The show is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Music by Stellwagen Symphonette.